The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I have no doubt at all that at the end of the day, all of the debt that's been created, the currency turbulence that lies ahead, there's no question in my mind we're going to see meaningfully higher gold prices against the dollar, the euro, and the yen within the next 12 to 24 months. And I think the central bankers are all pulling on the chambers that are pretty much empty.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. The guests that we have today, Dave, our listeners have heard many times because he goes back as far as friendship and sharing experiences with your father all the way back to the 1970s. Ian McCavity.
It's a very small community of people who have been looking at the markets very, very critically and been writing about the markets, not for years, but decades.
Yes.
And in this case, close to a half a century. Ian and my dad are both interested in the way the world works. Ian's approach is a combination of fundamental analysis and also technical analysis. He's one of the charter members of just about every technical analyst society in the world and is very, very highly regarded for his work kind of interpreting what does this picture mean? Not as in sort of a Rorschach test where it's much more subjective, but what do we know of history? What are the trends that play out the psychology of the market showing up in lines and charts and graphs? So it's always a fascinating conversation with Ian. We count it a privilege to have had him on the program every year since we started the program nearly 8 years ago.
What I love about Ian, too, is it's not just fundamental analysis, it's not just technical analysis, but he somehow knows how to wrap it up like Will Rogers used to. You know, he can say a single phrase and tell decades worth of wisdom and knowledge. And, you know, it makes you chuckle.
Well, I think you know your subject when you can distill it down, and he can. To oftentimes, things that are so pithy and sort of one-liner-ish, I'm reminded of sort of G.K. Chesterton thinking, that is the most quotable. I've got to remember that.
Yeah.
So without further ado, our guest, Ian McCavity. Welcome, Ian. Glad to have you back on the program again. You know, we have traditionally this period of time, if you're looking at the Stock Trader's Almanac or what have you, you wouldn't want to bet against stocks in an election year or the fourth year in a presidential cycle. Yet it appears that 2016 and 2017 may have a lot in common with 2008 and 2009. What do you think?
I think they've got a great deal in common with 2007, 8, and 9, because in many respects, the big bailouts of that era were much more driven by the Fed and the banking system than by the political cycle. And I think that we're now basically perhaps on the fringe of the second half of the systemic challenges to the banking system. I'm extremely skeptical about what I see. And when the Fed starts to raise interest rates, or tries to raise interest rates, I don't believe that they're going to get four interest rate increases done. I'd be surprised if they don't actually cut them sometime by mid-year when the global economy starts to really impact the U.S. economy.
Well, so we had the Fed-driven on the last go-round, 2007, 8, and 9, and you say less politically influenced. Having been through a full cycle of decline and then recovery, quote-unquote, with that monetary policy offering something of a boost, what do you see in this political cycle? More fiscal stimulus, or could you even go back to the monetary policy side with any real credibility?
I think we end up, in terms of the political cycle, the thing that amazes me is all of the honchos of both the Republican Party and the Democrat Party. I still don't think they really get what the Donald Trump phenomenon is all about. He's basically reflecting Main Street's anger with Washington, and it doesn't matter what party they are. Main Street has not been treated well by Washington under the two terms of Obama, and you know, even when the Republicans had control of various houses. And Main Street is mad, and that's what Trump is tapping into. And this political cycle is particularly interesting in the context of Hillary as to whether or not she should be in jail rather than running for president on the one hand, and Trump on the other hand, who scares everybody. So it's an amazing political cycle, but I think what we've started 2016 off with, this massive liquidation of financial assets, tells us that the shadow banking system is coming under stress in response to all of the good words that the Fed is trying to issue, but the shadow banking system is heading for the exit.
So having the worst four-day start to the year in the S&P 500 index specifically, going back to the very inception of that index in 1928, does that mean anything to you?
Well, I know about the first day and the first 5 days and the January barometer and all of that stuff. But I think what we're seeing right now is something a little different in the context that upside volume, downside volume ratios basically peaked in 2014 when the Fed first started talking about tapering off the QE3 stimulus. And they didn't actually taper it off until, you know, for months later. But in essence, you've started to have a diminishing balance of on-balance buying. And most recently, a cumulative on-balance volume line has broken down in this four-day period. And I take that as a really serious technical indicator that we've completed a topping formation that's got a lot of time on it. It's a big pattern in terms of the volume.
Well, typically policy shifts, thinking of monetary policy here, they can be a trigger for something, a long-term positive, long-term negative. Let's assume that the Fed believes their own BS and judges, according to the CPI and according to the U3 unemployment stats, that we really do have a broad-based recovery. What does the continual lifting of interest rates pretend?
They're pretending to be getting back to quote-unquote normal. The zero interest rate policy has been an extraordinary distortion of market forces for several years now. And I can respect them wanting to get back to something resembling normal, you know, where there should be a return on capital of some sort. But the problem is they flooded the system with so much liquidity on the one hand, and so much of it is in bad hands driven by bad motives. You know, it's all basically for robo-trading now. That the Fed really sort of painted themselves into a corner, and they're trying to pretend to get out of it, but I'm not sure that they can. Because it's not just the Fed at this point. You've got the ECB and a variety of central bankers around the world basically mimicking the premise that somehow if they can get the stock market up, that that will trickle down and do something for the economy.
And it seems like on a broad base, people are beginning to discount that. Certainly, you and I agree that raising rates another four times in 2016 puts central bank policy on a collision course with the equity markets and risk assets in general. But all we have in the bag so far is a single rate move in December. You've said before, and I've heard it other places too, three steps and then a stumble is the classic description of what it takes to convince the markets that a real policy shift has occurred. Maybe you can talk to me about the stumble that you might anticipate. And if we saw that, do they reverse course and instead take rates into negative territory?
Well, Europe did. Switzerland has. Part of the problem is they're still pretending to be trying to create some inflation and doing everything in their power to ignore the word deflation because it has such nasty connotations from the 1930s. In point of fact, what they've done is they inflated asset values in a world that is basically experiencing deflation. You know, and the stronger dollar is adding deflationary pressure to them. And you know, to me, the old three-step and stumble rule was when you had sort of long lags in monetary policy and they were not frequently, should we say, managing on a week-to-week or month-to-month short-term kind of a horizon. But for, you know, really going back to the tail end of the Greenspan era, you know, the central bankers basically, you know, they claim to be data-dependent. I think the S&P 500 is the most important piece of data in all of their deliberations. You know, I think they're more driven by the stock market than they are by a lot of the things they claim to be trying to monitor. And, you know, the premise of a central bank trying to manage unemployment and inflation at the same time, essentially, they've got a mandate that they can't really be attained. You know, the central bank really should be only concerned about monetary policy and a stable, credible currency. But somehow they feel obliged that they have a tap that they can turn on to create jobs. Just doesn't really hold up. You know, that's the game that we've been pushed into over the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, the popularity that comes with being a master of the universe is something that seems addictive for the crowd as well. But back to that issue of negative rates, if the central bank begins to get re-involved, do the equity markets start behaving as they did between 2009 and 2015?
I'd be very surprised at this point. I think that the tide has shifted on equity markets globally. Again, most global stock markets peaked out a long time ago. Only the U.S. market kept on making higher highs, you know, up until the past 6 months or so. most of the world peaked out in 2011, some in 2011, some in 2013, 14. But in essence, I think we've started a global bear market. And the problem that the U.S. has now is that they've flooded so much of the world with so many dollars that that becomes the global money supply behind those markets. And when you've got the majority of those smaller markets heading down, it's almost impossible, I think, for one market to go against that trend, no matter how big it is.
Well, here in the U.S., if we are, in fact, in a decline economically now, which I would argue we are, and I think you would agree with that, this would be the third major decline economically and or in the stock market in the 15 years since we started a new century on a new millennium. In real terms, we haven't made any progress to get excited about.
Exactly. Well, the great secular bull market in my book dated from the 1974 lows to 1998-1999. You know, 1998 was the bailout of the long-term capital management, a major Asian market crisis, and then the tech bubble kept on going into the beginning of 2000. But in essence, we put in three very, very major speculative tops. The 2000 top was largely the tech bubble. The 2007 top saw more of a financial bubble. And the interesting part about the top that we've been putting in for the last 2 years is it's coming down to a debt bubble that is even touching into sovereign debt, where you've got Greece and Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and a number of global countries where the sovereign debt has come into question. And in essence, you've had more money thrown at keeping this one going than ever before. And in many respects, if you think of somebody with a six shooter, once you've heard six shots, you expect the next one's probably just going to be a click on an empty chamber. And I think that the central banks are rapidly running out of bullets that they can fire.
Well, that ties into what Richard Fisher, the retired Dallas Fed president, said recently. He said the Fed is a giant weapon with no ammunition. He went on to say that, yeah, the markets are digesting a front-loaded rally, which was compliments of the Fed. So, I mean, what would you expect, Ian? A contraction or just a flat line for a long, long time, the equivalent of the invisible crash that we had between 1966 and 1982?
Well, in essence, what they're trying to create is an invisible crash. They're trying to create some inflation to keep the illusion. And I'm just not so sure that they're going to be able to, because I think that the bubble that is going to get popped is in financial asset prices. They changed the rules back in 2008-09 so that the banks didn't really have to account fully for a lot of the problems that were hidden in layers down in their balance sheets. And I still look at this mountain of hundreds of trillions of dollars of derivatives, which they claim they've got a valuation metric on them. But when you look at the gross amount of the derivatives, just remember that a derivative is essentially a daisy chain. You don't know who all of the parties are in that chain, and when one link breaks, suddenly that whole chain is contaminated, not just the little volatility ratio that they're measuring. So, you know, you've got hundreds of trillions of dollars of these things out there, and I don't think anybody really understands the mechanics of them or where the risks really lie. The banks have been enabled to essentially hide a lot of that.
And this brings back an interesting question, but what I was asking earlier about policy shifts, you know, the Federal Accounting Standard Board, you've got an accounting rule that was used during the context of the crisis to make banks look healthier than they were. And one of those regulations just rolled off the books, the debt valuation adjustment, or DVA. It's no longer going to be included in net income. So you have this subtle shift in how people account for loans that have soured, and they were actually able to take losses and turn them into paper profits in the context of 2008, 2009 with this FASB rule. It's gone now. And again, so it's almost like you think everything's healthy and you start peeling back the layers and you realize, oh my goodness, inside it's still rotten to the core. And we've just had these artificial things that have allowed us to perceive health and stability.
That's why I'm referring to the bear market that I think that has now started as part two of the 2008-2009, because they didn't cure much of anything. All they did was put it under the rug and push it off into the future. You know, they kicked the can down the road. The problem is they're running out of road.
So if it's a play in two acts, number one, the intermission seemed a little bit longer. It certainly was longer than I expected.
Well, basically, that's what QE3 was all about. I think Bernanke panicked at the end of 2012, because that break that we had in 2011 was tantamount to what would have been a normal rebound off that crash. In 2012-13, we would have been going into the next leg down. And QE3 was basically brought in a panic, or QE3 and then QE4, because they started buying just the mortgage debt and then government debt as well. They panicked to make sure that that leg did not happen. And that's, to me, everything we've had in the stock market from 2013 into the middle of 2015, I refer to as the Fed QE3 bubble.
So let's look at something kind of odd from the beginning of the year now. Gold and the dollar are rising at the same time as 2016 begins. This is different. It's positive for gold. But what is the broader significance?
This is the reflection of the Forex turbulence that I think is building up. We have had this before where gold and the dollar have risen together in prior periods. And basically, it's a shifting of the gears in the relationship. If you think of the post-Bretton Woods era as really being driven by three major currencies, it was the dollar on top. It was previously the Deutschmark, now the Euro. So all the history that I show on the Euro, I just convert the Deutschmark history. And then later on in the 80s and 90s, the yen became prominent. So, you know, I think it was the yes, we can currencies, the yen, the euro, and the dollar. But in essence, so much prosperity was spread around the world that the rest of the world basically had real industrial revolutions on their own and real growth and created real wealth. And they've now got governments that have built up a lot of reserves by exporting to the established world. And they've started to stand on their own two feet and resist what I call the old boys club. And particularly after they threw Russia out of the international payment system after the Ukraine incident, that pushed Russia into working much more closely with China on essentially developing an alternate payment system, which they are doing step by step, with the Chinese controlling it very effectively. And they're now attracting Saudi Arabia, they're attracting India, a lot of these major external holders of dollars are increasingly going to be working more closely with the Chinese and resisting some of the urgings of the old boys club, or what I call the old guard, or, you know, the colonial attitudes of the old establishment.
And that still is the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, which sort of are the old establishment in terms of the banking community.
Yeah, and the Bank of England. It always amazes me. The number of American financial experts that seem to have English accents tells me that there's a colonial attitude still behind a great deal of American foreign policy and international monetary policy.
Well, so what are oil prices signaling here? Near at 11-year lows for Brent, do you see more of a supply story, or does demand factor in as well if we have a slowing global economy?
I've had a view for well over a year that the oil price was going down to the 30s because the Saudis never forgave Obama for throwing Mubarak under the bus in Egypt. And when he started cozying up to Iran, basically, I think we're back into a 1973, 74, 75 oil war where the Saudis are using the oil weapon in retaliation to American foreign policy moves in the Middle East. And it's become particularly egregious doing the nuclear deal with Iran now. And basically, I think the Saudis were putting the oil price down. You know, when it was over 65, I was talking about the Saudis putting it down into the 30s. To put the Canadian oil sands, the Venezuelan oil sands, and the U.S. frackers out of business, just in retaliation for America basically separating somewhat from them. And, you know, subsequently, we now see the degree to which supply-demand considerations are in there. But to me, it was driven largely by the Saudis and political retaliation. That, to me, has been the driving force on it. I think we're probably going into the mid to low 20s, because there's no question it's done huge damage to the Canadian oil sands. I'm not sure what the Chinese are doing with the Venezuelan oil sands. We don't hear much about it. And I'm just wondering how much of all the junk debt that was floated to build the U.S. fracking industry, how much of that junk debt is in American banks, and how much of it were they able to export into all the banks in Germany? I suspect that a lot of that debt's ended up owned by some of the smaller banks in Germany that basically become the dumping ground for Wall Street's bad paper.
That's an interesting point. You know, one of the things that many companies will do is try to accommodate in their models for short-term volatility. But like we've seen with the metals market, maybe things going beyond what was anticipated, at least from our vantage point, if oil stays down a considerably longer period of time, you have to roll your contracts for the oil majors who've been largely hedged to this point. You've got to roll your contracts and you really begin to face reality as time wears on. How long do you think the Saudis can continue to play that game while they're sort of eating through their foreign currency reserves?
They're burning up their foreign currency reserves at probably at a scary rate. My guess is that they're probably beefing them up a little bit in the context of probably shrinking the proportion of their foreign reserves that are in dollars. And they may well be getting a little help from the Chinese. And, you know, they're going to start increasingly selling their oil for other currencies than dollars. To me, the death of the so-called petrodollar has been underway for a while now. The other element that I don't hear many people talking about is the degree of derivative contracts that are outstanding on oil and who actually has the risk on them. Because it's sort of amusing that, you know, when we had $130 oil, all of the airlines were slapping us with energy surcharges and all that kind of thing. But, you know, believe it or not, with the oil price under $40, you're still paying energy surcharges to the airlines. You know, you're taking, you know, $90 or $100 off the oil price, but we still have to pay a surcharge. You know, to what degree have the airlines shot themselves in the foot with some of their hedging? And how about the investment banks that advised them on buying these marvelous ways to lose money? You know, they destroyed American Barrick with hedging programs. And to what degree is a lot of American industry got a hedging problem that's going to come back and bite them?
So we have oil prices signaling something here. What are copper prices signaling?
Copper tells you certainly that global manufacturing is down. Again, the copper market got distorted because copper in many respects became a monetary instrument within the Chinese shadow banking system. And that a lot of that stuff is coming back out again. But, you know, I go back to, there was a CFTC report, what was it, back in, I think, 2012 they reported it. And, you know, there was a period there in 2012 where J.P. Morgan by itself, you know, they basically had control of any number of industrial metal markets, you know, through their trading and their long positions. See, in 2011, J.P. Morgan's inventory of aluminum exceeded 3.3 million metric tons, which was more than half of U.S. aluminum consumption that year. What is a bank doing owning half of the national consumption of aluminum? What's that got to do with banking as opposed to being a hedge fund trader? You know, and how many other markets have they been doing that stuff in? And that's what concerns me. And what amazes me is we're continually told that the gold and silver markets are the only unmanipulated markets around. And every time the banks get caught manipulating a market, they get a slap on the wrist, and I suspect they keep doing what they were doing before. I think that there's a lot of problems within the oil market that can actually come back into the banking system as much as the supply and demand at street level. The biggest single mistake in U.S. fiscal and financial and securities markets policy to me was, you know, eliminating Glass-Steagall in 1999, essentially gave the major Wall Street banks the license to become casino operators. And we've not really heard anything about that since. You know, and it's the same. I used the aluminum example, and you're talking about copper. At that time, J.P. Morgan controlled 200,000 metric tons of copper, 100,000 metric tons of lead, 6.5 million barrels of crude oil, and then plus more heating oil and gasoline and jet kerosene. And they also mentioned that they controlled tolling agreements at 31 power plants. You know, the involvement of J.P. Morgan, Goldman, Morgan Stanley, that core group of derivatives issuers, they had their tentacles on everything in the commodity boom that's subsequently gone bust. And you just don't know where the risks and where the cockroaches are going to start coming out from under the carpet. You don't know where that's going to come from. I don't believe that any of their academic professors in Princeton have got the correct formula for what the actual value at risk is. I know they don't know.
Well, do we see any of those cockroaches beginning to emerge in the credit markets?
I think that they're starting to. I think we saw it, in, again, it was a way of exposing some of the structural problems to the whole ETF business when you started getting this wave of redemptions coming out of some of the junk bond ETFs. You know, there's a presumption that all those ETFs are perpetual instruments of liquidity, but you get a wave of redemptions coming out of them, and suddenly the market makers are just not going to be picking up their phones because they haven't got a market to sell it into. And the breaks in the high-yield junk bond ETFs, I think, were really quite instructive that the system is starting to come under a fresh round of duress.
The liquidity that is implied in an open-ended fund isn't necessarily there when the underlying assets don't have market makers that are willing to back them to the hilt, is essentially the lesson.
Exactly. Then the other problem in the bond market is, you know, traditionally in times of stress, the first sort of haven that money would flow to in the financial markets would be into government bonds. But the problem is the Fed's bought most of them. The Fed owns most of the government bonds at this point. So you haven't even got that much liquidity in a lot of government issues.
Well, going back to gold for a minute, we've had central bank demand for gold, which has been on the increase. Jewelry demand, which is more or less predictable year to year, doesn't change a tremendous amount. What do you think are the circumstances that drive investor gold, which is kind of the swing vote in the market, back into a favorable position with gold?
Because of this increasingly short-term focused robo-trading, you know, all the algorithmic trading that goes on, trends, in a sense, become self-sustaining to some degree. You know, there's no question that the algo traders have got themselves into the mindset that a strong dollar means a weak gold price. And, you know, they trade the ratios between gold and other metals as well. But to me, the biggest thing and the most simple definition of trend is it's one thing to put in a bottom and do some basing, but you still have to produce some rallies with a higher high. And there certainly has been pretty concerted efforts that every rally we've seen in the last 3 years has been blown out of the water. And what's extraordinary is that the way some of those tops have been put in is by a massive seller, you know, stepping into the market at 10:30 at night just before Hong Kong opens when everybody else in the world has gone to bed, and all of a sudden somebody's selling 5,000 tons. You know, if you're trying to maximize your proceeds, you don't wait for the single least liquid moment of the day to hit the market. And yet that's what we've been going through for the last couple of years. To me, the real evidence that the game has changed for gold will be when we get a meaningful higher high, which is probably somewhere up in the high 1200s, 1320s, somewhere in that range. You know, there's no question we're seeing some promising action in recent days, and we've seen some encouraging action with the gold mining shares bottoming and holding their low when the gold price itself made a slightly lower low. That's historically been a pretty bullish indicator in the cyclical bottoming process. It doesn't say we go to the moon tomorrow, but it's a bottoming indicator. There's bottoming evidence building, and what worries me is the group that I call the javelin catchers. Every time we get any kind of a bounce at all, suddenly you get a rush of people saying, that's it, here we go, we're going, you know, gold's going back to 1800 or 2000. I refer to them as javelin catchers because I remind people that, you know, javelin throwing was an Olympic sport, but javelin catching never had enough survivors to mount a full team. And that, you know, in essence, the bottom pickers, I think, are just a little ahead of themselves in the short term. But I think we're in the bottoming process. I still wouldn't be surprised if we saw one stab under 1,000 just to really pull everybody's chain one last time. But I have no doubt at all that at the end of the day, all the debt that's been created, the currency turbulence that lies ahead, there's no question in my mind we're going to see meaningfully higher gold prices against the dollar, the euro, and the yen within the next 12 to 24 months. And I think the central bankers are all pulling on the chambers that are pretty much empty.
Well, we mentioned, or you did, the gold miners and their outperformance relative to gold as a positive sign in the market. Silver has yet to really confirm that. What are your thoughts on silver and sort of the gold-silver ratio?
I'm probably going to be putting something out in the next 24 hours. The piece that I did last night, I was running out of time and energy to do a piece on silver, but I'm even more bullish on silver outrunning. But at the same time, silver will tend to lag on the turn. But then once it gets going, it becomes gold on steroids. And, you know, we've had multiple bottoms in the silver-gold ratio when you've been in the 78 to 80 area, which is where we're back to now. And you get any kind of positive sentiment going in the market, and you're going to see the gold-silver ratio back up to 40, which implies that silver is going to outperform gold by a factor of two. I love silver, but again, there's no rush to buy it tomorrow morning. I think by the time we get the gold market going, silver is going to get its track shoes on, and it'll be surpassing gold probably towards the end of the first serious lap that we do on the upside.
So with the track shoes in mind, curiously, we also have platinum in a ratio to gold, which you'd have to go back to 1980 for the equivalent sort of discount to gold. Does that make gold expensive, platinum cheap? What else would you read into the charts looking at platinum?
Well, I think of platinum as a very expensive industrial metal, where gold and silver are still monetary metals in the minds of Jane and Joe Sixpack all over the world. And part of the problem I have with platinum, there's no question platinum's in a very bizarre situation, particularly because of the problems in South Africa, which is where most of it comes from. And the one challenge to platinum, which I used it years ago, I tracked the platinum-gold ratio, but I stopped doing it years ago, when they shifted the focus over for a lot of the pollution devices and cars to palladium. Because for a few years, we thought that there might be some way of trading back and forth between the platinum and palladium ratio. And if whenever one got out of line, the automakers would shift back. But then I talked to a guy that was a metallurgist, and he explained that once you switch over to palladium, you're never going back to platinum. It's a very different, more expensive process. And so I gave up on the idea of ever trying to trade a platinum-palladium ratio. But the problem with platinum is it's such a tiny market. I really don't pay that much attention to it anymore.
Let's talk about allocating capital in the context of competitive currency devaluations. You know, by implication, if gold is increasing in the context of dollars, yen, and euro, it says to me that all three of those currencies, probably along with a host of others, are in decline. What are your risks? What are your considerations? What's your advice when it comes to investing in the context of a competitive currency devaluation?
The competitive currency devaluations have been going on for some time, and the biggest problem that I see is an awful lot of people think that they want to get into a currency that they've never owned before, and they start viewing it as a trading chip. You know, years ago, you know, when it was popular, everybody in America wanted to boast about having a Swiss bank account. And when you actually talk to an awful lot of them, they'd never been to Europe before. And yet, when you ask them about it, they say, well, if, you know, when a crisis hits, I want my money in Switzerland. And they say, well, it's a long swim in a crisis. You know, to me, a lot of the currencies are not really appropriate for people that aren't globally inclined. And, you know, for Canadians, if they go down to the southern states for warmth, you know, the snowbird crowd, it makes sense for Canadians to hold some U.S. dollars to cover their winter expenses. And similarly, I think the proximity of Canada to the U.S., it makes sense for Americans to travel north to maintain some balances in currencies they actually use. And I'm very concerned about the viability of the euro with this sort of radical Islamic invasion of refugees coming in, because there are divisions that are unfolding in Europe that are really quite scary to watch. You know, the separatist movements, you know, independence movements that are starting up in Spain, the Scottish incident last year will be returning. I'm just very concerned about the political structure of the European Union and the European monetary system, so I'm not sure that I'd be going to Europe at this point. The Canadian and Australian dollars, they're going lower for as long as the export commodities are going lower. The Canadian dollar, I'd be interested in buying it at 62 cents, not at 72 cents. Now, I think we're going down into the low 60s again, where we were back in 1999 to 2001. But for the most part, for most individual investors, I wouldn't get too caught up into the currency arena, because I know that a lot of smaller short-term traders get sucked into a lot of these highly leveraged internet forex trading systems that invariably are just going to cannibalize your capital. Because there's going to be volatility where you're going to get hit with margin calls in the middle of the night and that kind of thing, where you're going to be just liquidated out. You know, I still trust the Swiss system from a longer-term stability point of view, but again, they're caught up right in the middle of the potential vortex of whatever's going to unfold in Europe. The problem the dollar has, and this is the strength that the dollar has right now, is you've heard me use the line for several years, that basically the dollar is the best-looking horse in the glue factory. It's winning because everything else looks worse. And the problem with that is the U.S. can't afford to have the strong dollar get much stronger, because then it starts to severely impact the earnings of all the U.S. multinational companies. And basically, a strong currency exerts a deflationary force, and the last thing that the Fed wants is any more deflationary forces on the U.S. economy.
Well, certainly, as we've looked at the numbers coming through the last couple of quarters, it looks as if we're at the end of a profit cycle with U.S. equities. So any additional pressure would be unfortunate at this point for the U.S. equities markets. When you look back at previous profit cycles, and then look ahead, what we might have in the next 12, 24, 36 months, what do you see?
Basically, we're into a global slump, and that global slump is not going to turn around quickly. China put us on notice that they were transforming their economy to building domestic consumption, and they're having a hiccup at this point. But the rest of the world just assumed that China was going to be this perpetual vacuum sucking in every commodity on the planet. And, you know, China for 2 years talked about making the transition that has now surprised everybody. The world had plenty of notice that this change was coming. And there's no question they've got all sorts of problems that are starting to pop up on them. To me, the biggest surprise is that they haven't had more problems. for the amount of extraordinary growth they put on over the last decade. You know, and they're going to come through it. And I think probably the biggest difference is that, you know, 3 to 5 years from now, China is going to be economically stronger, where most of the mature world is sort of hoping that they might be relatively where they are now, 3 or 4 years from now, if they can sustain it. The emerging markets made real progress over the last decade. They're giving some of it back, and they're going to give a little more of it back over the course of the next year or so. But they've made progress where the rest of the world has not really made much progress at all. We've just buried ourselves in more debt problems.
So there's a wide acknowledgement of an industrial recession globally, here in the U.S. as well. What are the odds that we contain that and keep it from spreading? And keep it just in the quote-unquote industrial sector?
That would be unusual in my book. I'd be surprised.
We would agree.
Globalization was a wonderful thing for a while, and it basically kept on going and accomplished a lot on a global basis. But once it gets into a period of turbulence, that turbulence, it's like a nasty hangover. You can't wish a hangover away. You got to go through the process. And the problem is, back in 2008, 2009, they didn't really let the markets clear. A lot of that mortgage debt should have just gone up in smoke. It shouldn't have been bought by banks and sustained and maintained. And they were just in reluctance to sort of let a market clear out. You know, it's in a sense kicked the can down the road and causing the bigger problem when it does surface. As things slow down, we're going to see them try to kick the can further down the road. I don't know what rule changes they're going to come up with this time, but for sure they'll try.
And this brings us back to, you know, sort of Act Two in the play we know as global recession / depression. You know, when you look back at the charts, you see some interesting relationships from 1966 to 1982. There was a pretty rough period for stocks, and it was a great period of time for gold. So if you're looking at the Dow gold ratio, that was a period of outperformance for the metal. You increased your purchasing power pretty considerably. There was a 2-year period in there that was very rough for the gold owner and great for stocks. I'm wondering if we've just kind of lived through an extended version of 1974 to 1976, where it was no joy in Mudville for the gold owner those couple of years, and the stock investor looked like a genius temporarily.
Well, think back to what was happening. You know, when the gold price was liberated in 1968 to 71 at $35 an ounce, the first run basically took it up to $200 an ounce, or $199 on January 1, '75. That was the day that Americans were allowed to buy gold, you know, that was non-numismatic. That was when the right to own gold was restored in the U.S. And because I was operating in Canada, and we were all waiting. We were all waiting for the American buyers to come storming in on January 2nd of 1975, but somebody forgot to give them the phone number because the gold price topped out just prior to that and then proceeded to go from 200 right back down to 103 in mid-76. In many respects, that was a very strong period for the equity market and a very poor period for gold. That's really what that corrective period was. And I agree with your analogy of that 74-76 correction in that great run in the Dow gold ratio. And I think that that's what we've been in since 2011. It's been much more extended, and it's been extended in many respects because of the QE3 and all of the extraordinary measures that Bernanke threw into the system. But at the same time, to me, when you look at it, the ratio basically retraced about one half of what it moved, and it seems to be stalling around the same levels that it was in back in 2006. And in a sense, on the run up, 2006 was a fairly material breakout point. So we ran into resistance. We haven't turned the ratio yet, but I think that we are still headed sometime in the next few years. The way I refer to it is, you know, with 2020 vision from 2020, I think we will have seen a crisis that will have taken the gold ratio back to something like a 2-to-1 ratio.
Well, so those are the kinds of extremes that you would ordinarily associate with a crisis. We got as low as a 6-to-1 ratio in the global financial crisis circa 2008 and 2009. And then that number has reversed course, again, similarly to the way the Dow gold ratio reversed course in 74 to 76.
Bear in mind the other extreme on that. It was when gold was flat in its back in 1999, 2000. You could take one unit of the Dow and get 45 ounces of gold for it. Yeah, that was really the beginning of the modern gold cycle. And to me, that's the cycle that we had this tremendous run-up. That we're still in the corrective mode, and I think that we are still, in the next few years, headed back down to that 2-to-1 ratio. And that would be the other extreme.
So gazing into the future, your 2020 vision sees sometime between 2020 and 2025 on the calendar, something like a Dow Gold 2-to-1, maybe even 1-to-1.
Yep, exactly. Well, we've been below 2-to-1 three times, 1896, 1932, 1980. And is anyone going to try and tell me that the financial mess that we've got today is less than any of those prior crises? I just don't see that this isn't the greatest financial crisis in the history of mankind, you know, when it starts being unglued.
So looking at the categories of danger, I mean, we've been talking about a great financial crisis immediately ahead. Well, financial crisis and economic crisis, there's some interrelations. But looking at the greatest categories of danger, what keeps you up at night? Economic, financial, cultural, political, martial, what would have you concerned?
I would say geopolitical in the Middle East and Europe, and the fact that there's a crowd that are almost trying to provoke a war. My biggest fear, when I see the riots in Paris and in Germany, there's a divisiveness that just has too many shades of the past that make me really uncomfortable. I've never been more uncomfortable in my memory. I remember having some Jewish friends in Europe when the Russians rolled the tanks into Prague, about 20-odd or 30 years ago, and watching some of the stuff I've been watching on the international news in the last couple of weeks is just really is spooking me.
Who wins in the context of military conflict if there is someone trying to provoke a war?
Cockroaches. They'll be the only survivors.
Resilient little buggers, aren't they?
You can't kill them.
Even after you step on them.
You might appreciate one of the lines that I've come up with in the recent years. I finally have figured out in the evolutionary Darwinian chain as to where cockroaches came from. And I finally think I've identified the link. I think there's securities lawyers.
Uh-huh. Well, we appreciate your thoughts. Missing deliberations on world markets on a consistent basis. But no, you've had a couple of busy years and look forward to you republishing at some point. When you're ready to launch that, we'll let our listeners know so that they can benefit from your wisdom.
I will be writing something. One big change that I've suggested for years, and I know philosophically you're in the same camp, in the context that the true value of gold is it's the ultimate intergenerational wealth transfer mechanism, you know, in terms of the longer-term preservation. It's not a trading tool, it's longer-term wealth preservation, the purchasing power preservation. One of the points with some of the rules they put in now about holding larger quantities of gold, I've recommended to an awful lot of people that the best thing a grandparent can do for the grandchild is to just at every Christmas, birthday, anniversary, special occasion, just put another 1 ounce coin into a pickle jar for that child. And I bet that in 10 to 15 years time, or when that child is going to college, that pickle jar probably will go farther towards paying for the college education of the grandchildren than any other financial instrument that's out there. We don't really know what the deflation, inflation consequences are going to be or what the currencies are going to be. But holdings of small gold is what I've really shifted my focus over towards that. And the other point I wanted to make, if I can give one little plug for the one entity that I'm involved with, the Central Fund of Canada. We were upheld in a challenge of the Alberta Supreme Court where the non-voting shareholders tried to give themselves votes and the Alberta court turned them down. But Central Fund of Canada is gold and silver. It's 45 ounces of silver for each 1 ounce of gold. And I've been the champion of the silver component of it because of the silver volatility. And when I see Central Fund trading in the area of a 9 to 10% discount to net asset value, if somebody's worried about a 10% correction in the precious metals prices from here, it's already priced into the Central Fund shares. So, you know, I'm a director and very much involved in it. I own the stock, so I'm completely biased and speaking from a long biased position. But in the current climate, it strikes me as something people should be paying some attention to.
Well, and as a professional asset manager, we use Central Fund of Canada, and it is a very useful tool. And you're precisely correct. When you look at a 9 to 10% discount on a closed-end fund, you can factor in and sort of give yourself a cushion for any further decline in the metals price. So, you know, if you wanted to buy sub-$1,000 gold today, you can do that via CEF. If you wanted to buy closer to 1250 silver, shave off 10% and whatever your number is, that's where it's at today. So buying that at a discount, the nature of a closed-end fund is it does trade at premiums as well. And I think that the value of having that as a closed-end fund can't be overstated. So we do appreciate the last couple of years your defending the position. CEF was recognized as sort of a gem, and another firm wanted to own it outright. I think you did a good job defending its status for a U.S. investor because it gives us a number of intriguing benefits.
It's been an interesting battle to observe sort of the pressure that somehow an ETF has a daily tracking mechanism. Yet there's a very long history of closed-end funds as a very useful investment tool for money managers because they typically will trade at a discount to net asset value on a bear market. And they have typically traded at a premium to net asset value in the subsequent bull markets. So in a sense, the closed-end funds is the most conservative way of building in a little precious metals leverage in the right market climate without having to use margin or any other, taking that much more risk. But the challenge has been that somehow or other, the ETF model tracks on a daily basis. To me, central fund was designed for investors, not for traders.
That's right.
It's an investment instrument. And so to me, there's a battle underway in the markets for the continuing existence of the closed-end fund structure. I think it's a very important structure to protect.
Particularly with the metals. I mean, when you look at having a position in metals, number one, it offers you some geographic diversification. Number two, it allows you to see an asset mature from a short-term capital gain to a long-term capital gain, which you don't have with a number of other products. So truly, what you just hit on is very important. Precious metals being, number one, an intergenerational wealth preservation tool. And I love the picture of putting a coin in a pickle jar each year and having something to show for it. Your kids, grandkids being able to cover their expenses and look at something like a college education as a very reasonable expense priced in gold. And as you mentioned, your status with the Central Fund of Canada. Thank you for the work that you've done in the metals markets and in the markets in general, analyzing world events and their impact on a variety of asset classes. As you head into your mid-70s, you're looking back at a lot of years, a lot of gyrations, a lot of interesting changes, and we'll be very interested in the wisdom that you share with us in the years ahead as you continue to publish your thoughts and share them with our audience. So it's greatly appreciated. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much, David.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Ian McCavity. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.